Samuel. I have preached before and firmly believe that there's always a straight path to obedience. And by that I mean that no matter how far you've dug yourself in, through bad decisions, through ignoring God's standards and precepts, there's always a right thing to do. Okay, the farther you dig yourself in, the harder it becomes, is the only problem. Because the more we build ourselves upon disobedience, the more our foundation is going to fail, right? The more sand we've got under our building, and the more of it is going to be destroyed when we start trying to tear out the sand and rebuild on a better foundation. But I always believe firmly that there is a straight path to obedience. There's always a right thing to do. And throughout the narratives that we've been studying in the Old Testament in David's life, we've seen examples of him choosing that straight path, and we've seen examples of him not choosing that straight path. So the first part of Samuel, if you had to summarize, the first part of David's life, you would say, is it following the straight path or not? Generally speaking, following the straight path, right? During his running from Saul, he generally picked the right way. Through his early years in his kingdom, he generally picked the right way. But what happened right about chapter 14 or so? Yeah, we start getting examples of David's disobedience and the consequences that come from that. Even Absalom's rebellion and Absalom's treatment of his brother were all indications of David's failure and the consequences that come from it, all the way back to Bathsheba. But a lot of those were things that were sown even in his early years as he was beginning to have children. When he was crowned king in Hebron, he started to have his kids. And the seeds that he sowed there of not raising them towards the fear of the Lord are shown much, much later in life. It's one of the troubles of of some of the decisions that we sow is we tend to like things to grow quickly. I mean, who doesn't like putting lettuce in the ground and being able to eat it just a few weeks later? That's lots of fun. But how long do you have to cultivate a fruit tree before you get anything off of it? Years and years and years. You know, for years, I never planted asparagus. I love asparagus, but I thought it takes 2 or 3 years to get good asparagus off of them, and I just don't feel like waiting that long, so I wouldn't plant it. Well, duh. Then what happens? You never have asparagus, right? So, yeah, well, we move here, and praise the Lord, we've got a nice, well-established asparagus plant that I didn't have to do anything for. Love it. That's the kind of gardener I am. I want immediate results, right? So, gardening is one of those things that teaches us that. There's no such thing as an immediate gratification. The trouble is that when we start sowing bad decisions, it does often take years before we start reaping the fruits of those things. And then when we do start reaping the fruits of it, we try to change things, and we hope that the consequences of good decisions will come right away. But they don't. It takes time. So if you've been sowing bad decisions, if you have been plucking those dandelion heads and blowing them into your garden, making wishes for the last 10 years, you just better plan on having some dandelions in there for quite a while, right? Even if you say, you know what, no more blowing wishes into the garden. We're going to stop that. And I diligently go through the rest of my yard and I kill every dandelion I can find before it starts sprouting seed, right? So I'm just out there all the time killing off dandelions. What's going to happen in my garden? Those dandelions are going to poke right up, aren't they? Because they're hard to kill. They're hard to completely get rid of. And sin is the same way. Its fruits sometimes take years to begin showing, and then when we want to make a change, the change doesn't happen right away. So we're getting into a passage. We are in a section of David's life that though it is generally chronological, we can trace the chronology of it, it is also very, very topical. So, we have seen with Bathsheba and Uriah and Absalom and even with Joab and all of the things that have been going on in David's life, David is reaping the fruit of sins that he sowed in his life. That is still the case when we come to this passage tonight. And I'll just tell you up front, this is a tough passage to deal with. Because, and here's where I tie this together with my thoughts on always a straight path. I believe there always is a straight path. But guess what? We don't always take it. Because it's too hard. We look at that straight path and say, "Ugh, boy, that's just going to be really difficult to do that." And so we don't take it. And I think this is one of those instances where David has a straight path, but he doesn't exactly take it. And this is the account of a problem that was also sown years and years ago. So we'll pick up in chapter 21, verse 1, avenging a broken oath. Now, there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years. So if we park right there for a moment, we have to realize that, first of all, this is not necessarily chronologically inserted in our text. The historian who's giving us this to us didn't give us a time signification like he usually does. So we can't quite place this exactly in David's life. There are some markers in the text that can help us, but when he says now there was in the days of David, he's really giving a signification that this is a whole new topic. This doesn't connect to Absalom. It doesn't connect to Sheba's rebellion. Doesn't connect to any of the events that we have been studying in detail. This is a whole new event. But it did take place sometime in David's reign. Now, trying to pinpoint that, we're going to notice that, first of all, it's during David's reign, so that puts us within a 40-year period, right? David reigned for 40 years. Now, there's also a marker later on that talks about Mephibosheth and David wanting to spare Mephibosheth. Well, in the course of our narrative, we know that David didn't even know Mephibosheth existed until David was king in Jerusalem. It was after he became king in Jerusalem that he started purposely seeking out an heir of Saul or an heir of Jonathan to show kindness to. So how long was David king before he became king in Jerusalem? Yeah, about 7.5 years he was king in Hebron. So we have our 40-year time span of David's life, and we know that this event cannot have taken place before he became king in Jerusalem. So now we're down to about 33 years of time. At this point, that might be about all we can do to narrow that down, other than to say that because of what happens in this, it's more likely that this happened in the middle part of David's reign than it is that it happened later. So just as an educated guess, we're going to say that David has probably been king about 20 years. It's entirely possible that this happens very late in David's reign and that the historian places it here to signify that. Okay, but because of the markers that are not given in the text, usually he tells us then or gives us after a time signature, and he doesn't do that here. So we're left just sort of guessing when this event happens, okay? There was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year, and David sought the face of the Lord. So this famine is obviously something that is not normal. Not being much of a farmer myself, I'm not exactly sure what a normal course for droughts and famines is, but from what I understand, 3 years in a row is pretty abnormal. Usually, you might lose, what, 1 in 10 years? You'll have a really bad year? I'll look for nodding of heads. Okay, a couple of nodding yes. We'll take that as an authoritative answer from those of you that know better about farming than I do. So you might lose 1 in 10, somewhere around there. 1 in 7, and but 3 years in a row is a serious matter, and so David recognizes this is an event from the Lord. God did talk about in the law using droughts and famines as a means of disciplining his people, and so come the third year of famine, David realizes this is not normal. He begins to seek the face of the Lord as to what's going on and why God has brought this famine upon them. God gives an answer, and the Lord said, "There is blood guilt on Saul and on his house, because he put the Gibeonites to death." This is going to require some history that we'll delve into here. Actually, the chronicler here gives us a little bit of the history in verse 2. "So the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not of the people of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites. So that's all we get from the historian, just to remind the reader that the Gibeonites are not part of the people of Israel. They're not Israelite in descent. So as we go to our map, to give us a little bit of a spatial idea, Gibeon is a city located just 7 or 8 miles northwest of Jerusalem. So here's Jerusalem, and you travel up here to Gibeon. It was a pretty important city. There was generally a high place maintained there. The tabernacle resided there near Gibeon for a very long time. And even after David established Jerusalem as the religious center of Israel and moved the ark there, most of the tabernacle actually remained in Gibeon. The altar was still there. And so David, when he moved the ark, it doesn't seem like he moved the entire tabernacle. He just moved part of it, all right? And so Gibeon was a pretty important place. Now, the historical significance of the Gibeonites being of the remnant of the Amorites is going to take us back to the book of Joshua, chapter 9. So if you want to turn back there, we're going to go back to the book of Joshua. Now, understand, you are backing up in history roughly 400 years by turning these pages. Your Bible's a time machine. You get to travel through time and see what God has done throughout the history of the world. It's a fascinating thing. So we're backing up 400 some odd years. Joshua is entering the land after Moses has died. He's bringing the people of Israel across the Jordan. He actually already has. And they are camped in the land of Israel. Actually, at that point, it's still the land of Canaan because Israel has not yet taken possession of it. They have defeated Jericho. They've defeated Ai and several other cities. But they are mounting their offensive to try and take over the Canaanite lands as God promised them. And so as they are camped there in chapter 9, some of the kings of the area, it says in verse 1, the kings of the who were beyond the Jordan in the hill country, in the lowland, all along the coast of the great sea towards Lebanon, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, and the Muscatabites heard of this. And they gathered together as one, thank you for laughing, as one to fight against Joshua and Israel. They gathered together. So they decide the only way to defeat this massive army of 700,000 men coming into the country is to join together. Now, we typically think of nations today being as somewhat large estates, lots of land, lots of people, generally speaking. America, we recognize as one of the biggest nations on earth, go USA, and we want to keep it that way, don't we? But back in these days, nations were composed of one city, sometimes just a few cities. They were not huge. They were loosely affiliated conglomerates of cities, and each city had a king. They're called city-states. And so these kings decide they're going to band together to fight against Joshua. But, verse 3, when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and to Ai, they, on their part, acted with cunning and went and made ready provisions and took worn-out sacks for their donkeys and wineskins, worn-out and torn and mended, with worn-out patched sandals on their feet and worn-out clothes, and all their provisions were dry and crumbly. So you get the idea that everything's worn out that they're taking, because they have a plan that they've concocted to save themselves from the onslaught of the Israelites. They went to Joshua, this is verse 6, in the camp at Gilgal, and said to him and to the men of Israel, "We have come from a distant country, so now make a covenant with us." But the men of Israel said to the Hivites, "Perhaps you live among us, then how can we make a covenant with you?" Why does he say that? Maybe you live among us, we can't make a covenant with you. Why does he say that? Why does he say you can't make a covenant with you? They weren't allowed. God had prohibited Israel from making any covenants with the people of the land. Because his order to Israel was, you're going to go in, you're going to wipe them all out, and then you're going to dwell there. Okay? And so you weren't allowed to make covenants with the people of the land. So when these Gibeonites come, they present themselves as having traveled a very great distance. And that's going to be part of their deception in verse 9. They said to him, "From a very distant country your servants have come, because of the name of the Lord your God. For we have heard a report of him, and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon, the king of Heshbon, and to Og, the king of Bashan, who lived in Ashtoreth. So our elders and the inhabitants of our country said to us, 'Take provisions in your hand for the journey, and go to meet them, and say to them, "We are your servants. Come now, make a covenant with us. Here's our bread. It was still warm when we took it from our houses as our food for the journey on the day we set out to come to you. But now, behold, it is dry and crumbly. These wineskins were new when we filled them, and behold, they have burst. And these garments and sandals of ours are worn out from the very long journey.'" So they present themselves as having made this grand trek across the land to make a covenant with Israel. And if you'll notice, they cite some things that God did to Egypt and to the kings beyond the Jordan. But do you notice what they leave out? The crossing of the Jordan, the defeat of Jericho, the defeat of Ai. Why do you think they might have left those events out of their report? Yeah, because they just happened. So if we report something that the news would not have had time to travel to us, if we live far away, then they're going to know we're lying. And so when we left our house, all we had heard about was your defeat of Egypt and your defeat of the kings across the Jordan. They're pretty sneaky, right? Well, they convince Israel. Verse 14, "So the men took some of their provisions, but did not ask counsel from the Lord. And Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live. And the leaders of the congregation swore to them." So they enter into a sacred oath with this group of people that they will not kill them. Well, a couple of days later, because they are very close, all right, Joshua is camping over here in Gilgal, down in the Jordan River Valley, and Gibeon is just right over here, 20 or 30 miles away. And a few days later, as Israel is moving out with their raiding parties, trying to figure out which way they're going to go, they discover, these Gibeonites live just a few miles away. They live in the land. We were supposed to destroy them all, and now we can't because we've sworn this sacred oath. Now what do we do? Well, they can't kill them. They've sworn. Even though they shouldn't have made that oath, now that they have made that oath, does God want us to keep our promises? Well, you better believe he does. God takes oath-taking very seriously, and that's going to be one of the lessons that we derive tonight. Because this was 400 years before David. So there's the history of the Gibeonites. Israel swore a solemn oath not to kill them. What they did do to the Gibeonites is reduce them to forced labor. So the Gibeonites became the people who would cut the wood for the altar fires in the tabernacle and would draw the water. And they were the ones that did all the menial, servile labor regarding the tabernacle. And so they put them to forced labor. All right, fast forward 400 years and go back to 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel 19. Nope, sorry. 21. 2 Samuel 21. When David seeks the face of the Lord regarding this drought and famine that's in the land, crops are not growing, people are suffering greatly. God says there's blood guilt on Saul and on his house because he put the Gibeonites to death. We'll look at Saul's motivation for that in a little bit, but right there, God lets us know how seriously he takes our promises. 400 years later, God says this oath is still in effect. Nobody should be taking out the Gibeonites because you guys swore to it. So how important are our agreements? How important do we take them? How seriously do we take the promises that we make? Well, God takes them pretty seriously. So, this idea of blood guilt on Saul and on his house is going to get explained here in a little bit. So, we start in verse 2. The king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. The Gibeonites were not of the people of Israel, but remnants of the Amorites. And although the people of Israel had sworn to spare them, Saul had sought to strike them down in his zeal for the people of Israel and Judah. So there we've got Saul's motivation for this. Saul wanted to strengthen the kingdom. And if we think back to Saul's life, much of his reign as king was in trying to solidify the kingdom. Because Israel was a very disconnected people. They were only loosely connected tribes. And Saul was trying to bring them all together under one government, something that had not been done until that time. So for the 400 years or so that Israel was living in the land of Canaan, since Joshua brought them in, they have been very, very disconnected. But now they're all trying to come together under one government. That's tough to do, isn't it? It's been interesting reading for me in the last few months as I've read a history of the Revolutionary War here in America, how difficult a task it was to bind 13 loosely affiliated colonies under one government. Now, we look at the Constitution today, and the fight is to get back to the Constitution. But back then, the fight was whether or not they even wanted it. And there was a significant portion of the population that didn't want the Constitution because they wanted the states to be much, much stronger than they are under our current system. So anytime you try and form new political entities, new governments and authorities, there's a fight. There's going to be a struggle on both sides, and that happened under Saul, and it's happening under David, isn't it? He's fought several revolutions to try and oust him from being king. Well, Saul, in order to try and solidify his rule and try to make Israel great, was trying to eliminate from Israel every non-Israeli influence. And so here he lands on this city of Gibeonites. Wait a second, they're not Israelitish. They're not descended from Israel. They don't look like Israel. They don't talk like Israel. And yet we've been letting them live in this land for the last 400 years. You know what? I think they need to go. And rather than kick them out of the land, Saul decides to deal with them by slaughtering them. Now that's all the details we get, because nowhere else in Scripture is this plan ever mentioned. Except that he tried to kill off some of the Gibeonites. And we don't know when that was. We don't know what he did. We don't know how many there were. But we do know that back in verse 1, when God responds to David, he tells David there is blood guilt on Saul and his house. That blood guilt is a term referring to murder. Saul and his house are guilty of murder. Now, we've looked at the statutes under the Old Testament for murder. And there was only one way to atone for murder. There was no sacrifice for murder. You couldn't go to the tabernacle and offer up a goat or a sheep. What was the only way to atone for murder? Life. Execute the murderer. Right? Well, wait a second. Saul's already gone. He's already dead, isn't he? So this is where this passage is going to start presenting us some problems with deciding what's the right way to go and what's not the right way to go. Because as we have said throughout the narratives, when you encounter narrative in Scripture, just because it happens doesn't mean it should happen. Right? And just because a hero of the faith does it doesn't mean he should have done it. So Lot ran off into the caves with his daughters, conceived two children with each of them. Lot's a hero of the faith. Should he have done that? Does that become normative for us? No, absolutely not. We've got to look to the commands and principles that are clearly given. And so we understand when we're reading narrative, you have to evaluate the actions based on previous commands that have been given. So we're going to try to tie some of this together as we go back to the law and what David should have done. So Saul obviously should not have killed off any of the Gibeonites, and because he did, he is guilty. And his house is guilty. There becomes the problem with why this famine is continuing in the days of David. So why does God choose to punish Israel for the death of the Gibeonites during David's reign and not during Saul's reign? Why does God bring a famine for that anyway? Because Israel, as a nation, made that covenant. So as a nation, they are liable for it. Saul, as the leader, is the one who stands responsible for those decisions, right? So the entire nation is going to suffer for this breach of faith. Saul himself is the one who bears the guilt of it because he's the one that enacted it, but the entire nation does bear guilt and is going to suffer some of the consequences. And so, there's the background. Here's why the famine has come on. So now David knows that. In verse 3, David said to the Gibeonites, "What shall I do for you? And how shall I make atonement that you may bless the heritage of the Lord?" So he's asking, how can we make this right? Why does he go to the Gibeonites to do that? Yeah, they're the ones that were sinned against. It was a covenant with them that was violated. So they're the ones who have the power, the authority to decide how to rectify the situation. Okay? Because the covenant was with them, they're the ones that have the right and the authority to determine how to correct what was wrong. What's going to appease them? Because it was a violation against them. This idea of covenants is an extremely important one in understanding our relationship with God. Right? Because we exist in a covenant relationship with God. And you are under one of two covenants. What's the first one? What's the first covenant? We're all born under it. It's law. Right? We are under the covenant of law. Now, how do we all stand under that covenant of law? Guilty. Okay. That's a covenant with God. So if we break that covenant, we're breaking faith with Him. And He, therefore, has the right and the authority to determine how to rectify the situation. What is the punishment for breaking that covenant? Death. Okay, here's where we all stand under the old covenant. We're all guilty. We all deserve death. Now, along comes Jeremiah 31. I will make a new covenant. Not based on tablets of stone, but I'll write the law in their hearts, right? And then Jesus comes along and holds up that cup and says, "This is the new covenant in my blood." So when you drink that cup, you are signifying publicly, I don't belong under that covenant, I belong under this covenant. Now, what are the terms of this covenant? What are the terms of the new covenant? Grace. What's that, Jim? Yes. I enter that covenant through faith in His Son, and under that covenant I am treated with grace. That's why John can quite literally say in his epistles that the one who has faith in Christ does not sin. You know why? Because under the new covenant, this isn't about what you do. You can't break the terms of that covenant. Once you're in it, it can't be broken because it's not based on you, it's based on Jesus. He was perfectly obedient to all the terms of the old and the new covenant so that when God looks at us, He doesn't see us anymore, He sees His Son. And so every time I hold up that cup, I say, I'm in the new covenant. And boy, am I glad of it. So, Israel is under a covenant with the Gibeonites. They have broken faith in that covenant, so the Gibeonites have the power to say what will restore the covenant. And this is where we start to get into a little bit of trouble. Okay. Verse 4, the Gibeonites said to him, "It's not a matter of silver or gold between us and Saul or his house. Neither is it for us to put any man to death in Israel." In other words, we're not looking to just slaughter a bunch of people here. We don't want to make restitution by killing off thousands of the people of Judah or even by a specific number, say, look, Saul killed 100 of us, we want to kill 100 of you. Okay, that's what they're saying. So we don't want money. We don't want to slaughter off your people. So David, pushing a little farther in his negotiation, says, "Well, what do you say that I shall do for you?" And they said to the king, and I think here's why they're a little leery to tell him exactly what it is they want, because what they're asking for is neither lawful nor easy. But here's what they ask for. They said to the king, "The man who consumed us and planned to destroy us so that we should have no place in all the territory of Israel, let seven of his sons be given to us so that we may hang them before the Lord at Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord." Oh, ha. Okay, now we have some ethical matters to think through, don't we? They don't want to kill off an equal number of people in Israel. All they're asking for is that seven sons of Saul are handed over to them to be executed. Now, we have to understand that even the Lord himself said that the house of Saul bears blood guilt because of this matter. So whether one of Saul's sons or a couple of his sons participated in the slaughter of the Gibeonites, that's a distinct possibility. But somehow, the house of Saul, not just Saul himself, bears the guilt of this. Tim, you got a question?
Yeah, when it says the house of Saul, does it mean all Benjamites?
No, just Saul's descendants. So you would have his sons and his grandsons and things, all right? So it's not all Benjaminites, that's a good question. Just Saul's family, direct family. So here's what we're asking. We want seven of Saul's descendants. Hand them over, we'll execute them, and that'll satisfy us. Now we have a bit of a problem. Because can anyone think of why we have a problem? Abby?
Because Jonathan is one of the sons?
Jonathan is, but where is Jonathan?
He's dead.
He's already dead. Tim?
David swore an oath to find one of Jonathan's sons and treat him with kindness.
Jonathan, yes, and that's going to become an issue that David's going to consider here. David did swear an oath to show kindness to one of Jonathan's sons, so he has to take that into account. But there's another thing he should take into account, and that's that God in the law commands that a son will not be put to death for the sins of his father. Right? You don't just execute sons just because their dad was a bad guy. So David has a tough road to hoe here. I guess it's a tough row to hoe, isn't it? You don't hoe a road, that'd be really difficult. You think about some of those sayings that we use all the time, hoe the row. Obviously, it's a farming metaphor, but you know how many years I heard people say toe the line and thought they meant like hooking a chain up to a line and pulling it along, and it's like, what? No, it doesn't mean that. It means put your toes up to the line and get yourself in order, right? So you're standing in a straight line with the rest of the guys. So toe the line, T-O-E the line, not T-O-W the line. Yeah. We use a lot of crazy euphemisms in English. Really trip us up. Yeah. So anyway, David has this conundrum, because what happens if he doesn't hand the people over? There's still blood guilt, and then what'll happen? There'll still be a drought. Israel will still bear the guilt of their crime against the Gibeonites. Okay, what if he does hand them over? He's breaking God's law. Okay. Now, we could assume that all of the people he hands over had a direct part in this, until we read the list. So let's go on here. The king said, "I will give them." Verse 7, "But the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Saul's son Jonathan, because of the oath of the Lord that was between them," between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul. So there's one oath that David's going to honor. He recognized, I can't violate my oath with Jonathan, so I have to protect Mephibosheth. So he's not going. All right. Verse 8, "The king took the two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Ahiah, whom she bore to Saul, Ammoni and Mephibosheth," must have been a popular name in the family at the time, okay, "and the five sons of Merab, the daughter of Saul, whom she bore to Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Meholathite. Okay. Anybody recognize that name, Merab? Former fiancé of David. When David was young, Saul promised, because David defeated Goliath, he promised to give David Merab, his oldest daughter, in marriage. And so David was going to marry this gal. And when the time came for him to marry her, Saul gave her to this fella, Adriel, the son of Barzillai the Meholathite. So she married this other guy and apparently had children with him. So we've got to assume that Merab and David were somewhat close in age. It's possible that she was several years older, probably not too much older though, right? So that was somewhere around 10 years before David became king. Even if we push this to the end of David's reign, that doesn't matter much, because Saul dies 10 years after David was supposed to have married this gal. How old can her children be before Saul dies? 10's the oldest, right? 10's the oldest. So does the 10-year-old take part in the slaughter of the Gibeonites? Probably not. Most likely not. So would David hand over 10 children to be executed? Boy, we hope not. It's possible, but boy, we hope not. This is one of the dating markers that helps us push things at least to the middle of David's reign. Because if we're right around 20 years in David's reign, then that makes these kids at least right around 20 years old and a little older. So they're full adults when this happens to them. But at the same time, that shows that the five sons of Merab probably had nothing to do with the slaughter of the Gibeonites. Yeah, probably. I don't know. Saul was kind of a crazy guy. Did he put a sword in the hand of his 7-year-old grandson and say, hey, prove yourself a man, go get them Gibeonites? Maybe. Probably not. Okay. So this is where we run into the difficulty, is it really seems like at least these five grandchildren have got to be innocent. Now what about the two older ones? These were sons of Saul's concubine. Very possible that they were involved and that that's part of the blood guilt that's on the house of Saul. But we're going into conjecture there, aren't we? So we just have to at least mentally note that that's a conjecture. That's not something that's specifically stated. Whatever the case, David hands over these people. He gave them into the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them on the mountain before the Lord, and 7 of them perished together. They were put to death in the first days of the harvest, at the beginning of barley harvest, which makes this in early spring. One of the problems we have here is that because the command of God was you don't execute sons for their father's crimes, David is putting himself in violation of God's law here in order to fulfill the terms of the covenant made with the Gibeonites. What could David have done? Gene, you have comment.
I just had a question. If this was a drought, and they didn't have any rain, how did they have barley harvest?
Well, there would have been something growing. I mean, even when we have droughts, a little bit grows. Right? It just would have been very scant. So yeah, this famine's going on, so they at least have some stuff growing in the field, but it's obviously not enough to support the nation. What other options does David have at this point? Eldon.
Yeah.
Oh, there's a good idea, huh? Yep. Do you realize that's the same problem that got Israel into this situation? Because they didn't ask God's counsel when the Gibeonites came to them. And it specifically says that. The Gibeonites come, they took of their stuff, they made a covenant with them, and they didn't ask counsel of the Lord. And 400 years later, David's reaping the problems of that sin. Don't think that we're ever isolated. Our sin has consequences. All Adam did was eat a little piece of fruit, by the way. How bad is that? Well, obviously it's terrible. But here we are 6,000 years later, we're still reaping the consequences, aren't we? Yeah. Go ahead, Gene. You were going to say something? Sorry, I thought I saw your hand go up. Okay. So, yeah, there were a lot of things David could have done. He definitely should have gone to the Lord and said, now, wait a second, which one should I do here? But he doesn't. Well, what would your sister-in-law's kids? Yeah, I guess those would be nephews to you, wouldn't they? Yeah, it doesn't seem like David maintained a great relationship with the house of Saul, just because of the nature of what happened there. But yeah, they are. I guess I never thought of that. Those are his nephews. So, okay, we're going to notice the faithfulness of another lady here in verse 10. Then Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth, spread it for herself on the rock. Now, Rizpah is Saul's concubine. Remember, Saul was quite a bit older than David, because Jonathan was 20 years older than David. So this Rizpah must be advanced in her years at this point, if she was the concubine of Saul. Well, you know what? I suppose a concubine, he might have married her later in life. Kings had a habit of doing that, you know. So this older men marrying really young women is not new. And so that's a possibility. But at any rate, she took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock from the beginning of the harvest until rain fell upon them from the heavens. And she did not allow the birds of the air to come upon them by day or the beasts of the field by night. So here she is defending these bodies from being desecrated by the birds and the beasts. For quite a while, actually. We've got another problem here. Because God also stipulated in his law that if somebody were executed and hanged upon a tree, they were not allowed to hang there overnight. Because he didn't want their bodies being tortured like that and desecrated like that. They were supposed to be buried. But here the Gibeonites, obviously not of the people of Israel because they don't care about God's law, and so they leave the bodies hanging upon these trees so that this woman has to stand there and defend them from being eaten. And she doesn't allow anything to touch them until David intervenes in verse 11. When David was told what Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, the concubine of Saul, had done, David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of his son Jonathan from the men of Jabesh-Gilead, who had stolen them from the public square of Bethshan, where the Philistines had hanged them on the day when the Philistines killed Saul on Gilboa. That's a complicated sentence, but if we remember back, Saul was killed by the Philistines in the north of Israel. His body was hung in the marketplace upon a very public wall, and the men of Jabesh-Gilead, who were Israelites, snuck into the city at night, sneaked into the city at night, recovered the body of Jonathan and Saul, and buried them in the city of Jabesh-Gilead, which is across the Jordan. They've remained there until this point. And so when David sees the faithfulness of this woman protecting her sons and their bodies, he decides it's time to bring everybody together and give them an honorable burial. So he exhumes Saul and Jonathan's bones from Jabesh-Gilead and brings them all back to Benjamin, verse 13. He brought up from there the bones of Saul and the bones of his son Jonathan, and they gathered the bones of those who were hanged. And they buried the bones of Saul and his son Jonathan in the land of Benjamin in Zelah, in the tomb of Kish his father. And they did all that the king commanded. And after that, God responded to the plea for the land. At the end of it, the Gibeonites can release their hold on Israel. They've satisfied the terms of the covenant, and God is able to restore the land to a place of blessing again. But the path to getting there was a little less than ideal. Because we see throughout in several places that David and the Gibeonites violated God's law to get to that point. But God does honor oaths. So when the oath was fulfilled, he was able to restore blessing to the land. But now you do have these other problems. They allowed the bodies to hang too long. That was a violation of God's covenant. They executed people who were innocent. That was a violation of God's covenant. Those things are going to come to play another part in Israel's history, but it's going to be another few hundred years. Because in 586 BC, anybody know what happens on that date? Babylon comes and destroys Jerusalem, destroys the temple. The prophet Ezekiel sees a vision of the glory of God leaving, departing Jerusalem and going away because his people had so trampled underfoot the covenant that he says, I divorce you. I'm kicking you out. And in effect, he does. He severs the marriage covenant between himself and Israel for a time to display to them, you have violated my covenant so badly that you're no longer allowed to dwell in my land. And as much as we love David, and hold him up as a hero of the faith. He was one of the kings who began it. The rest of the story of Kings. See, we're going to finish up 2 Samuel here before too long. David's near the end of his life. But the whole rest of the story of Samuel and of Kings and of Chronicles is a story of decline as God's people continually disregard his covenant. They continually break the terms of their oath with God that they made at Mount Sinai. There's always a straight path. God has given us clear instruction. In fact, Peter tells us in the book of 1 Peter that he's granted to us all things that pertain to life and godliness. So when we come to the pages of this book, if you have a question about what's the right course of action, it will be answered here. And I'm a firm believer in that as well, that there is no situation that lies outside of the revelation that God has given us in his word. We've got to search for it. We've got to study for it. We've got to pray about it and ask God to enlighten us. It's what David didn't do. It's what Joshua didn't do. But he will show us what's the right path. And if it contradicts what God says in here, then it's the wrong one, whether good consequences come out of it or not. Now, David was able to secure the blessing of the Gibeonites because he handed over Saul's sons. But was it the right thing to do? Not according to God's law. Would there have been another path if he had searched it out? Probably. Most certainly. But he didn't. So we learn from David's life, as we've seen throughout our study, that David was both a righteous man and a failure at the same time. Isn't that comforting? We can be righteous people and still make horrible mistakes. But the goal is to continue searching through the scriptures to say, I want to make fewer mistakes tomorrow than I made today. I want to be more obedient to God's law tomorrow than I was today, but also recognizing every time I break God's law, I bring consequences upon myself. I sow problems when I sow disobedience. And those are going to come to fruit later on. Any questions about this passage?